testimony on rule on redistricting. Committee, we have at your place the stuff we've gotten in. We don't have anybody signed up. Anybody want to talk about redistricting? Okay, the way it's been going. Close public hearing. We need four for the appointment. Okay. Senator Gourley, you want to start? We just got out of the caucus, so we'll open up a public hearing on SJR 31.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Avelle Gourley, representing Senate District 10 in Portland, which includes neighborhoods in Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I am here testifying in support of SJR 31, which references Juneteenth Independence Day, which continues as the traditional celebration of the day of which the last slaves in America learned of their freedom. Although slavery was officially abolished in 1863, news of freedom did not spread to all slaves for another 2.5 years. On June 19, 1865, when General Gordon Granger rode into Galveston, Texas, and announced that the state's 200,000 slaves were free. That first Juneteenth was a joyous occasion as the newly freed Americans of African descent danced and celebrated with jubilant voices their freedom. It did not take long for Juneteenth celebrations to spread beyond Texas and the states in the Southwest region into other parts of the country. And so today we have millions of Americans of all races, creeds, religions, and countries of origin in hundreds of cities, towns, and communities across the nation who celebrate Juneteenth. And this is due in large part to the hard work and dedication of individuals and national organizations like the National Juneteenth Observance Foundation, the National Juneteenth Christian Leadership Council, and Juneteenth America Incorporated. These organizations all continue to sacrifice and fight for Juneteenth Independence Day to be recognized as a national holiday. And there are at least three Juneteenth organizations in Oregon. Juneteenth is now a state holiday in Texas, Florida, Oklahoma, Delaware, Idaho, and Alaska. Many more states, including Maryland, Virginia, New York, California, Illinois, New Mexico, Ohio, Connecticut, Tennessee, Louisiana, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, Indiana, Rhode Island, North Carolina, and I could go on, have recognized Juneteenth Independence Day through legislative resolutions and the future introduction and passage of Juneteenth state holiday bill legislation. Now let me be very clear, I am not here today, we are not here today seeking a state holiday. That's not what this resolution is about. We are only seeking acknowledgement through this historic Senate joint resolution. As Juneteenth celebrations continue to spread, so does a greater appreciation of African American and American history. This is an opportunity to revive and preserve Juneteenth, not only as the end of a painful chapter in American history, but also as a reminder of the importance of preserving the lines of communication between the powerful and powerless of our society. All Americans share a common love of and respect for freedom, as well as a determination to protect the democratic institutions through which the tenets of freedom are guaranteed and protected. The 19th of June, or Juneteenth Independence Day, along with the 4th of July, completes the cycle of freedom for America's Independence Day observances. We often hear, until all are free, none are free, as a often repeated maxim that can be used to highlight the significance of the end of slavery in the United States. Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the foregoing reasons, I am here to respectfully urge you to support this resolution proclaiming Juneteenth Independence Day, a day for celebration statewide of dignity and freedom for all citizens. And I also wish to acknowledge Mrs. Clara Peoples, a longtime community activist in Portland who's now in her 80s, I believe, who has worked to get such a resolution into the legislative process for many, many years. She is not here today physically, but her guiding hands certainly and her spirit carried me through the work to get this presentation to you this afternoon. And I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Senator Gordley. Any questions? Comments?
Work session.
All right, thank you. Public hearing, open work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 34, the Senate floor, the pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves SJR 31 to the floor.
I'm sorry.
Nope, dash one, yeah.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw the motion and move the dash one amendments to Senate Joint Resolution 31.
Senator Gordley moves the dash one to SJR 31. Discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 31 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordley moves SJR 31 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered. And Senator Gordley, you have the duty, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I hadn't had the opportunity to talk to Senator Atkinson, one of our resident historians in the Senate, but I'd like him to join me in carrying the bill.
He'd be delighted.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the work session. Open the work session on House Bill 3107. Members, 3107, after we kicked it out the other day, the proponents and opponents woke up and found out there are some serious problems with the way the amendment was written, so we need to bring it back to committee and let them to continue to work it. So we need to reconsider we need to suspend the rules and then reconsider it and get it back in our possession. So,
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3107.
Senator Cordy moves rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3107. Any other discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3107 was sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3107 was sent to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered. And the motion carries and the vote on House Bill 3107 has been reconsidered and we have it back. So you guys get to work. I mean, how it turns out, I'll be real curious. Open work section, executive appointment, physical therapist licensing board, Cynthia Cunningham. What? I close the work session.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
I open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Cynthia Cunningham to the Physical Therapist Licensing Board.
Is that physical or physical?
Senator Cordy moves to waive the appearance and recommend the confirmation of the appointment of Cynthia Cunningham to the Physical Therapist Licensing Board. Discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered. Is she here?
You want to say anything in her defense?
Okay. Anybody want to talk about this one?
Which one?
Okay.
You might want to say which one.
Where are you?
Where are you?
So what are you? 3069?
Yeah, table it.
Wait a minute, don't do anything. I don't know where you are.
Open public hearing, House Bill 3069. Doug Tindall, Scott West. What's the problem here, gentlemen?
The problem.
Mr. Chair.
We don't need a bill then, do we?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott West. I'm with the Oregon Lodging Association, and we're here today in support of House Bill 3069. This bill rose out of the course of the last couple of years. There's been some problems during ODOT construction on intersections and such of tourism-oriented directional signs, the blue logo signs, those things going down during construction projects and not going back up in a timely manner, or else being lost and having to come back later a month later, and to reconstruct the signs themselves.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Senator Cornyn, did you introduce this bill?
Did we?
Yeah.
Yes, we did.
You introduced a bill that would require you to put the signs back up?
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, no. Currently, under ODOT regulation, when ODOT goes through to a construction site, if these signs come down, they're supposed to go back up on temporary standards. What's happened over the course of the last couple of years has been a pattern of those signs not going back up like they're supposed to. So this bill was introduced to address the issue of getting the signs back up in a timely manner.
Mr. Chair, who is going to put the signs back?
ODOT. Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney.
This is... You're telling me, you take them down.
He's not from ODOT.
I'm with the Lodging Association.
I feel better.
Would you like to hear from ODOT?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, thank you.
Doug, any more to add?
Chair Harper, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Oregon Department of Transportation, I'm the state maintenance engineer. Scott has summarized the problems we've had. They were unintentional on our part, but nevertheless, they were problems for the business community. We've been fortunate enough to work with Scott to come up with this language for this bill, and ODOT has no problem agreeing in this bill that if ODOT takes the signs down, ODOT will put the signs back up.
Every bill has a mother. Don't forget.
I know how I was born, Mr. Chair.
Well, it's public hearing of an order session.
Mr. Chair, I move...
3069.
House Bill 3069, A. Engross, to the Senate floor with two passed recommendations.
What makes you feel bad, term limits didn't kick in earlier, didn't it?
I can't freaking believe it.
You're about to, I'm not.
Senator Corley enthusiastically moves House Bill 3069 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none.
So, Miller objects to the record, just so you know.
Senator Miller objects. Senator Corley objects.
No, I don't object.
Senator Corley does not object.
Let me carry, because I could just definitely.
Can I find out what the good senator from like Oswego's reasoning is?
I believe the cost of printing and time taken exceeds the value of this measure.
Thank you.
You guys want to carry it?
I'll do it. I got to carry this.
Let me coordinate. Okay. Public hearing, House Bill 3268.
Even though it was a short hearing.
This will be good.
There we go.
John and John. John McCullough, John Tracy.
I want to consider.
You have to see it up, Mr. Chairman, because if you're saying yes to this stuff,
this is the cream of the crop.
Well,
how do you spell crop, people?
What's the problem here, John? What are we trying to
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. John McCullough, representing Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association. Dr. Tracy is not able to join me at this point, so I'll be flying solo here to explain to you this bill and hopefully not have as much...
Problem? What are we trying to...
Problem say? Is, Mr. Chair, is in many areas of the state, all over the state, speech-language pathology assistants are being used to provide clinical services to children and adults without any standards having been established for their involvement in that type of clinical setting. This has resulted from the fact that there are fewer professionally trained speech-language pathologists, especially in rural areas. There has been a need, increasing caseloads, and a number of these speech-language pathology assistants have come into being to provide certain services, especially in schools. We have been working on this issue for the past 7 or 8 years, finally developed a task force that studied the issue, worked with the licensing board with school-based speech-language pathologists, and bring House Bill 3268 to you. It establishes a certification program within the existing Board of Examiners for Speech Pathology and Audiology. That board will determine standards and will establish the necessary training programs to have people prepared to perform these clinical services. They will work under the auspices of a speech-language pathologist in primarily school settings, but also hospital and other settings.
Okay. Are these people doing the job now, and they'll now be certified?
Mr. Chair, those who can meet the standards that are established would be, quote, grandfathered, those who are doing them now, and there are many in school districts around the state. Klamath Falls is a perfect example. Gresham Barlow was really one of the pioneers in this area. There is an existing training program that has been established at Chemeketa that is doing a distance learning program, so all areas of the state are can avail themselves of the training.
Okay, and Senator Brown would like those people to be grandmothered in. Close public hearing, open work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3268 A engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 3268 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection. Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Miller objects. Yeah. Senator Byer, would you carry this one, please?
Oh, sure.
Public hearing, House Bill 3355. Charles? Doug?
I'll go crazy.
This one is good, Bill.
This
one is good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
What are we trying to fix?
Well, not necessarily trying to fix anything, just make things a little better.
So we want to close the work session.
For the record, my name is Charles Dyson. I'm here. I'm here representing Jackson County today. This bill would declare that it's a public policy in the state of Oregon to promote cooperation between ODOT and counties on road maintenance projects. Intent here is to allow ODOT and local county road maintenance departments to join forces, share some equipment, personnel, and save taxpayer money and be more efficient. Nothing in the bill, however, affects the ownership of any state highways or county roads. Partnership agreements that this bill would authorize would ensure that employees are properly supervised according to any collective bargaining agreements, require accounting methods to ensure maximum savings, and utilize equipment to its best possible advantage to the partnership. There's one small amendment before you. It was an oversight from the House side. It was the way the bill is currently drafted, any relevant environmental regulations or laws in any intergovernmental agreement would have to be included in the intergovernmental agreement. So we'd have to duplicate a lot of language. This amendment would simply allow us to use a reference as we currently do in the revised statutes.
Where did this amendment come from?
The amendment came from jointly from Jackson County and from OPU.
And from who?
OPU. Unions.
Yeah. What's the connection?
We've worked collaboratively on the bill throughout the session.
Okay. And it's okay with ODOT?
That's correct.
Anybody else affected here? Doug, how many of these agreements do we have going on right now?
Chair Harper, I don't know the exact number, but the stack of pages that shows partnerships with local governments is probably 20 pages long. We update that once a year, roughly, what the status is with all the various counties and cities in the state. So we're doing a lot. This bill will allow us to do more. It comes out as a result of a House bill, a study that was created by House Bill 3465 from last session. And it's just a bill that enables us, we hope, to do more. And I should have identified myself for the record as Doug Tindall, Department of Transportation.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Close hearing, open work session.
The A4 amendments to House Bill 3355.
Senator Courtney moves the A4 to House Bill 3355. Further discussion, objection. Senator Miller objects.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill.
Oh, no, I don't object to the amendment. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3355 as amended to Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
And then that is, you get that Senator Miller did not object to the amendment. And Senator Miller objects to all the rest of the bills for the rest of the session. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, inappropriate Senator Atkinson to carry that.
I think that's only fair.
He's not here.
So ordered, and Senator Atkinson will be the bill carrier.
I think Ricky has gone down and told the officials that he can't sign his speech.
Public hearing, House Bill 2763. Are you done already?
Here we go.
Mr. Wilson, what's the problem here?
Chair Harper, members, for the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the State Pharmacists Association for House Bill 2763. What we're doing is fixing the the industry's biggest workplace problem, as it has been identified. Mm-hmm. Currently, industry-wide studies confirm that a full 20% of a pharmacist's time is spent on insurance issues. This is unproductive time spent on a telephone when a pharmacist could, in fact, be engaged in the practice of pharmacy instead of adjudicating claims on the phone. This is not an acceptable situation for pharmacists. Much of it is due to the fact that prescription drug cards often lack the information that are needed to correctly process claims the first time. In light of the current shortage of pharmacists and increasing prescription volumes, this drain of time ranks as the number one workplace problem among pharmacists. House Bill 2763 fixes the problem by ensuring that all information needed to correctly process claims are placed on the prescription drug card. This will help pharmacists reach their goal of being able to process claims correctly the first time, every time. This language is agreed to by both pharmacists and insurers. It's consistent with what has just been passed in the state of Washington. So it makes sense that the same statutory language governs both states. It passed out of the House unanimously, and I ask for your support.
Insurance companies okay with this, what you just said?
Yep.
Does this apply to anybody else that would complain about this one?
Not that I know of. This was, Chair Harper, this was a discussion that we had with the insurance industries, and this we were fine with this language, and they obviously had to buy off on it, too, in order for it to fly as smoothly as it did.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill.
More session.
I move House Bill 2763 and goes to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cordy moves House Bill 2763 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
We go to Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. We'll have, let's see, who's not here? Senator Maskus.
Good pick.
Wait for amendments on this one. Okay. Open public hearing, House Bill 3448.
What happened to the other one?
We got some amendments coming.
Oh. Yeah. You're trying to
confuse us. Catherine.
You're right.
I'm sure.
What is this?
3448.
Let's see if I got that.
What are we trying to fix?
Well, Chairman Harper, I'm here to support proposed legislation clarifying the language of ORS 678. The current language of this statute requires nurses who live and practice in areas outside Oregon to obtain a temporary limited Oregon nursing license before they can take a nursing education course from an Oregon university. I'm on the faculty at the School of Nursing at OHSU. These are nurses who are licensed to practice in the state and they live in, but who are not practicing in Oregon. So a nurse in Idaho or Southern Washington, this would apply to them. They wish only to attend school here. There is currently a $50 cost involved, a significant amount of time lost in securing the necessary limited licensure, and there's no real benefit associated with this requirement. The OHSU School of Nursing delivers its academic programs to nurses throughout the state of Oregon and beyond. For example, many nurses in our regional area choose to attend our campuses in Ashland, Klamath Falls, and LeGrand, as well as in Portland. Nurses living in our border states see this requirement as a disincentive to advance their nursing education in our Oregon schools, and it sends a message that nurses are not welcome from outside Oregon. This is not helpful at a time when we in Oregon are actively recruiting to fill serious nursing shortages, particularly in our rural areas. Attending one of our campuses often provides the experience that then encourages these nurses to decide to move and practice in Oregon, particularly rural Oregon. And this is and at that time, when they come to practice, they do obtain the full required Oregon license. There is no support for the continuation of this old statute. Louise Shores from the Oregon State Board of Nursing supports this amendment, and speaking for the board states, we support this amendment in full and see no protection of the public issues. Essentially, what it's about is that if a nurse, say, from Idaho wanted to take one of our distance ed courses, even though she never set foot in Oregon, she would still be required to pay the $50 to buy a license. If she were to come here and do any practice whatsoever, she would have to get an Oregon license.
I understand.
So we want to change
very
it.
Very good testimony.
Oh, thank you.
Excellent. How many folks like this do we have?
It's not a big number, but it could grow, and mostly it just sends the wrong message.
Okay. All right. Closed. Open.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Since Gordy moves House Bill 3448 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? I'm a nurse. My wife's a nurse. I get the nurse bills.
Okay.
All right. No objection. Hearing none, so ordered. I'm carrying this one.
Didn't take $2,800 the other night. You voted against it.
Yes. I'm not that much of a nurse. You ready for this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Public hearing, 3145. Which one? Back to 3145. You signed up for this one. What'd you do with my folder, Peter?
I didn't do anything. You
took my folder.
I'm not messing with you, sir. I haven't been able to find anything.
That's not anything new for you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Devlin, are you on this one?
No, sir. I think she's relaying my
back. You didn't. You didn't.
I'm in the middle committee. We'll get it. I'll be done. Okay. All right, thanks.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. We were talking.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. And I'm here to talk about in support of Senate Bill 3145, and there are four issues that are now addressed in this. There were three earlier today, and the fourth one has just been corrected in the -10 amendments that I believe Mr. Bacobian is handing out. The first issue that this bill deals with is that it requires insurance carriers to provide a grace period with a notice to policyholders before a policy can be terminated. There's been some personal experiences with not with late premium payments, and the issue was to require carriers to provide a minimum grace period before it can be canceled. The second section, or the second issue that this addresses, is that the insurance division recently received an interpretation that a plan modification made by a carrier constitutes minor plan modifications. Could constitute a plan termination, which requires a series of notification requirements. What this language does is give
the carriers the ability to make plan modifications without having to send out a variety of termination notices when a policy is not terminated. The insurance division will define what these benefit modifications are in rule. The fourth issue is that there has been a requirement that insurers send a notice to the insurance division and to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, send a notice after any policyholder terminates its policy. And the fact is that that notice goes after the policy has been terminated, and as it turns out, neither BOLI nor DCBS do anything with the information. In our view, given the fact that this bill requires cancellation notices, and there are a host of other statutory requirements requiring people to be notified of their continuation options after a policy is terminated, we found that that was no longer necessary. The fourth issue is just an oversight in LC in dealing with the language that allows carriers to make benefit modifications, and there was a word that is dropped out that would have meant that small employer carriers would have not been able to make plan modification in the same fashion that carriers that offer group and individual policies can. And with that, I'd have answer any questions and hope you support the bill. Thank you.
Take me through once more the 8s, 10s, and 11s. Let me make sure we understand what they're doing. First of all, how come we're getting them now? Why wasn't this done in the House?
It was an oversight by LC, and in fact, I frankly said when I called today that...
All three of them?
No, just...
Okay.
The A-10s are the ones that we should be looking at, but this oversight in terms of small employer carrier was not picked up by the carriers, and I will take responsibility for not picking up on that oversight.
Okay, so the A-10s are an oversight that...
The A-10s incorporate the oversight as well as the -8s, which eliminate the requirements that carriers send notices to DCBS and BOLI. So those combine the termination of the notice requirements to DCBS and BOLI, and that appears, those amendments are contained in lines 1 through 13. On line 14 in the A-10s, that inserts the language carrier that now means the plan modification language will apply to small employer carriers, those that write large group coverage, and those carriers that write individual policies.
And the 11s, once again?
Yep. The 11s, I would have to defer to Mr. Bacobian because I didn't look at the 11s. I looked at the combined amendment.
Senator Harper, may I? -A11s were given just with the change only in case the committee decided to adopt the A8s and the changes separately. So the A11s are just the correction to the drop word carrier by themselves.
If we just decided to adopt.
The A-10s, that would take care of all of it.
Okay. Let me tell you what we're going to do, not casting just, anything on anybody. I'm not comfortable making amendments. We screw up things more often than we fix them, so I want to let this thing sit for till next week, make sure that we're all clear.
That would be fine, but there is a representative from the insurance division here that can speak to the addition of the term carrier. On line 14 in the A-10s, the language that preceded that in the A-10s was agreed to by everybody subsequent to discussions on the House side.
Let's just take it back. We'll bring it back up Tuesday, make sure that everybody, it says exactly what we want it to say, so we don't have to be fiddling with this thing for the rest of the month.
That would
or
be
you
fine.
Have to live with something wrong for 2 years, but It'll be fine. We'll bring it back Tuesday.
Thank you.
Just make sure that we got everything done that we want to do. Okay. Public hearing on 3145. Public hearing 2660.
Staff.
Ron Murray, Joe Landry.
Hi. Chair Harper, members of the committee, my name's Joe Landry. For the record, I'm representing the several subcontractor organizations, electrical, plumbing, mechanical, sheet metal, and air conditioning contractors.
And I'm Ron Murray with the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters, and also today with the Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors Association. And what we're trying to fix with this bill is simply to define the definition of the term reasonable. I'm a new lobbyist, and the term reasonable is kind of unreasonable to me. But for the purposes of this, when a jurisdiction or a local municipality is determining a fee or a permit fee, sometimes there's some discrepancy in what people feel is a reasonable increase. And where this actually would come into play, for example, is if a jurisdiction were, for example, to build a large structure and it housed the permit division. When the application was made then to increase the permit fee, it was reasonable to pay for the structure. So there are varying degrees of interpretation.
And what we'd like to do is just put some guidelines in place for the department when they review these fee increases. They will ask that the fees be calculated with similar methodology and provide the same level of service for the same fee type, and also charge similar amounts in similar size jurisdictions and geographic locations.
Questions for the witnesses, please? Oh. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2660 for the work session. Senator Byer moves House Bill 2660 and gross the Senate floor to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Gone. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3171A engrossed. Bob the Repine, Kevin the Mannix, Ron Eber, can't read, and when I tell you, I can put all four, I can't get any more than three. Wait a minute. Why can't I get John? All right, that's good. Yeah, John, let's go. John McCulley, please. I like to do it, buddy. Bob, hit it. Hit it, buddy. You're the man.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services, here to add our support for House Bill 3171.
Good morning. Excuse me, one second. I've just been chastised by the chair. You didn't want that last bill on the floor? It's gone, buddy. And I didn't, unlike you, I got every witness the next bill up here, not this 101 stuff. They're all up here. That's the Marine way, Air Force.
I've killed more people than one thing than you ever dreamed of.
Without, Mrs. Chairman, without restating my name for the record, I am here still to support House Bill 3171A engrossed, and there are some -A3 amendments that you have that are just amendments that resolve conflicts that exist in a variety of bills that are moving through the Assembly that deal with the similar issues, and so that's the amended that you see in front of you that I hopefully you will entertain also. I'll yield my time to people who have more certified smarts on this bill than myself.
Where did this thing come from, Bob?
Mr. Chairman?
Is every bill in the Assembly? What did you just tell me?
Not exactly, but many of them.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm an attorney in private practice appearing on my own behalf, but also
in regard to my role as chairman of the interim task force on farm worker housing, which came up with, I believe it was 18 consensus recommendations to the legislature and to the executive branch, many of which have resulted in bills which are moving through the process. This is one of the most important of those bills. It basically gets at the issue of what I'll call the bottom line is farm worker housing has been discriminated against in terms of the not in my backyard syndrome. This cleans up that problem. It's a consensus bill. It's received tremendous support. The A3 amendments are conflict amendments in case other bills pass. I'd urge passage of the A3 amendments on House Bill 3171A engrossed. God bless America.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Minnis.
Mr. Maddox, how does this clear up the NIMBY problem?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Minnis, the basic problem is that a number of zoning regulations are set up in such a fashion as to allow communities to refuse the establishment of farm worker housing because it's farm worker housing, even though if it was classified as multi-family dwellings or single-family dwellings, it'd be just fine. But because farm workers are going to live in it, they get to say, no, not in this community. This says, no, you don't get to do that. Farm worker housing gets to come in on the same basis as any other kind of housing. And the same goes for some special provisions as to structures built on farms to allow those structures to be built for farm worker housing.
Okay. Thank you.
You want to? Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House, the A3 amendments to House Bill 3171.
We open the work session. Senator Courtney moves the A3 to 3171. Further discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3171 as amended to Senate floor due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3171 as amended to floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, objection, hearing none. So ordered. Senator Castillo gets it. Thank you, gentlemen. Hearing 3536. Too late.
Hope
these guys liked it.
Who's up?
Yeah. John and Lori.
3566. Not 36.
Thank you. No,
3536. 3536.
This electric staff is.
What's broken here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger with Associated Oregon Industries. What's broken is this. There is a conflict.
No, not all of this.
There is a conflict between federal requirements and a provision of state law that is resulting in the DEQ's inability to get some program delegation from the EPA. As a result, we're having federal inspections. Companies are having to go to the federal government to get their permits, and there will be federal enforcement. We've been working closely with DEQ, has been working with EPA, and we're in agreement here, and we do have a solution to fix that problem.
Okay. Anything to add, Lori?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lori Onan with DEQ. We support the bill and happy to answer any questions.
So this fixes everything that we're constructing. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3536 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3536 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Under discussion, objection, hearing none, so ordered.
Carrier, that's
okay.
Senator Courtney would like to carry that one. All right, close work session. Open hearing 2123. Who wants to talk to 2123?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm Director of Debt Management at the Oregon State Treasury. House Bill 2123, filed by the Treasury, is a bill that comes from the Oregon Municipal Debt Advisory Commission, and it's a bill essentially for some technical correction to local government kind of financial transactions. The Municipal Debt Advisory Commission has been in business for 25 years.
Chuck, does this harm the public in any manner?
No, sir, it does not.
Public hearing.
Chair, I move House Bill 2123-34. Keep that recommendation.
Nobody can understand it.
Thank you.
Senator Cordy moves to House Bill 2123 to the floor to do fast recommendation. Discussion, objection. Hearing none, so order.
I'll carry it.
It's the only person on the committee that understands this thing. Vote for exception. Public hearing 2906. Ted.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes today representing the Cow Creek Band of the Umpqua Indians. We caused this bill to be introduced, and I'll tell you a story why. Short story. The Cow Creek, in their efforts to diversify from hotel, resort, casinos, have been entering into other business agreements. They purchased a truck stop across I-5 in Canyonville. It used to be called Fat Harvey's. You probably all, if you went down I-5, saw Fat Harvey's. We plan on, and we are expanding it greatly, and plan on making it the biggest and the finest. When we purchased this about 5-6 months ago and took charge of it, we start collecting the diesel off-road fuel tax, and we set it aside. And pretty soon it got to be quite a bunch of money, and we called the Department of Transportation and said, hey, we've got this off-road fuel tax for the highway fund. Come and get it. Or come down, we'll sign a contract with you, and you can, and we'll furnish you this money every time we collect it. And they said, gee whiz, we don't think we have the authority to enter into a contract with a sovereign nation, with another government. So that's what prompted this bill. This will straighten it out. When we passed the bill in the House, when we introduced the House, the Department of Justice had a problem. They thought it might give more authority than we were looking for. And we didn't concur with that, but we sat down with them and we came up with the -3 amendment. I think your committee has that -3.
And that's what.
And we agreed with it. If the Department of Justice feels more comfortable with the -3 amendment, that's fine with us. Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, yeah. One quick question to committee staff. I'm reviewing the relating clause, and it's my recollection from the Burns Paiute bill that the Cow Creek wanted to increase their allocation of ODF&W surplus harvest salmon. Would that provision fit into this bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, it certainly seems like it with state agencies and recommending you try it.
Would it? If it would, I'd love to do that.
Didn't we pass that?
You know, you're way ahead of me.
But Cow Creek wanted to increase their allocation, and it wouldn't fit under the relating clause of the Burns Paiute bill because the relating clause was relating to Burns Paiute.
Good record established.
Me, if this fits, we'd love to have that stuck in here. I never thought about it, Senator Brown. Thank you for bringing it up. I don't know if it's
the case. Save us the bill for next session, Mr. Chair. Save us $2,500 next time around.
Well, I'm for that.
Is it the relating clause you're looking at or the language of the existing contract issue?
Both. Well, I just made a record in terms of the germaneness on the surplus salmon issue, but if the relating clause to find out whether it fits, then I think it certainly fits. It's a agreement between ODF&W and the Cow Creek.
That's a contract, isn't it?
I would think so. Yep.
Perceptual amendment? Aye. I don't think you need an amendment, do you?
He's saying if you could move it to perceptual amendment,
what this means?
Just for the record, that is exactly what this means.
Yes, that's correct,
Chairman. Well, like most things we're doing in life, go do it and see who complains.
We'll come out with a better bill than we ever
figure out what to do next.
Boy.
All right.
This is a great committee. Thank you very much.
Hey, let's see. What was his last thing? Where are we?
-4 amendment or -1?
Huh? Well, you don't need anything. Just
oh, we don't. You don't think we need
it? Yeah, you do.
Yeah,
you do.
We need one sentence language, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right.
We'll bring it back to you too shortly.
I'd do it right. Can you put boxing and wrestling in there, too? That's Fat Harvey.
All right, we'll close the public hearing, and you're authorized one dash on me.
You're going to do it, Mr. Chair? So I'm going to have to write a note?
You can write a note. You can use my name, your name. You'd probably get better service than I would if I'd use your name.
Hey, Chip. Close public hearing on 29-06. Open public hearing on House Bill 2744.
I try to go to every one of my meetings. I can't remember. What is that?
Mike Swain?
Yes.
Joe Swinehart? Are you Joe? Oh, no, nope, you're Joe. Sorry. And who would you be? Mike, you're signed up first. You get to go, Mr. Mayor.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name for the record is Mike Swaim. I'm the mayor of the city of Salem. I'm also the treasurer of the League of Oregon Cities, but I'm here appear on behalf of the city of Salem. Although what I'm about to say applies equally well to the reasoning that has predominated my discussions and discussions throughout the League of Oregon Cities as well as the Mayor's Association on the issue of preemption of local control. Let me say that there have been some modifications I see to the bill, which makes it better because it exempts public employers from the exemption, I suppose, and does look at the issue of public contracts as being something within the domain of local government. That being said, what we're concerned about at this point in time is that there, to the extent that there are other areas which local governments might want to consider for purposes of a minimum wage or a fair living wage proposal, we believe that the state government should not be interposing itself between the local governments and its constituents in that regard. I also appear this afternoon just briefly to say that as recently as about 3 or 4 hours ago, I was in contact with somebody from the AFL-CIO who mentioned that my name was being essentially bandied about, suggesting that the city of Salem was interested in providing or promulgating an ordinance which would preclude any private employer within the city of Salem from conducting business on anything other than a living wage basis. That's not neither my position nor the position of the city of Salem nor anybody else that I'm aware of. I think it would probably be illegal, unconstitutional for the city to attempt to extend itself into the uniquely private domain of private enterprise. And even though it's a soluble goal for all employers to provide living wages to all of its employees so that people that are the working people in this country, and particularly this state and the city of Salem, should not be fully employed and yet qualified for and needing food stamps and other kinds of public assistance. But that's a matter of private decision, not something that the city of Salem legislates in. Finally, it appears that we'll still be able to do what the city of Salem has anticipating doing, that's to be sure that the city of Salem pays all of its employees a living wage. And we are proud to say that we're within $4,000 of being able to meet that goal, and we will meet that goal shortly. So we're in the process of doing that, and we're in the process of looking at whether or not we should require those that contract for services to the city of Salem, requiring them to provide a living wage to their employees as well. This is something that's under active consideration at this point in time. We'll be having a public hearing on it later this month. So I will conclude my remarks. I appreciate the opportunity coming here and being able to talk with you folks for a few minutes, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Joe?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt with the League of Oregon Cities. Mr. Chairman, I was waiting for you to ask me what's broken in this one, and the whole answer
what's
is...
What's broken in this one?
Nothing.
Nothing.
The idea is that this...
it didn't stop us so far.
League of Oregon Cities believes that cities should have the opportunity to increase the quality of life of its citizens. Why take tools away from local government to do that? This bill actually preempts an idea. The idea that citizens of any city may choose to try something new in order to advance the standard of living in their community. Why preempt local governments? There are no cities at this time that are taking a living wage to their borders. They are using for contracts, and they are using for their employees. But at this point, there's no reason to have this bill, and we think it's trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. Thank you.
Senator Brown. So I thought I heard on the radio last week, didn't this occur actually in Santa Clara, one of the beach communities, that the city had provided substantial amounts of subsidies for the hotels and businesses along the beachfront, and I thought I heard one of the cities.
Santa Monica.
Santa Monica, whatever.
One of Los Santas.
But it did happen in California.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. Are you Richard?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
I really don't have that much to add to what these two gentlemen have already said. I would just urge that this bill not pass out of committee. There's so much benefit that can be derived from local communities making local decisions about their local economies, and this would take a big amount of that control and power out of local communities, and it's inappropriate. Thank you.
I'm unclear, John. I don't see who the answer is. It hasn't been done in Oregon yet. Is that right or wrong?
That's incorrect. My understanding is that Multnomah County has provided living wage requirements for certain service providers and janitorial. My recollection is the city of Corvallis likewise has a living wage provision.
Contractually.
Mr. Mayor.
Contractually.
But not for private employers.
That's
Mr. Mayor,
right.
What you're talking about are people that are being paid by taxpayers' dollars. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is there any city in Oregon that's doing it in the private sector that is hiring into the private sector?
Well, I think we need to be clear as to what I'm what the question is and what I'm about to address. You have the private sector contracting with the public entity. That is what we're looking at in terms of the service sector. Then you have the private sector that is doing business in the private sector does not involve taxpayer dollars. We're not talking about that. I don't know anywhere in the state of Oregon that that's happening.
In the country.
I'm just not knowledgeable about that happening anywhere. I know that Baltimore has a pretty thoroughgoing measure, but I don't know that it applies to private employers dealing with other private entities and not dealing with taxpayers' funds.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Miller.
I was going to probably pursue the same line. There's no jurisdiction now that is dictating the private employers' wages.
Personally, I do not know of any, and I, you know, as an attorney, I practice law for a living. I'd find that a rather interesting imposition upon the right of contract and an interference with the contractual relations of private enterprise. So, that's not an opinion that you necessarily want to take to the bank, but it seems to me that would be an argument that would be made, is that it would violate the contractual relationship between private parties that have nothing to do with the municipality.
And part of the theme of the opposition is that if we got into this, we would be interfering with local control. Is that correct?
That's exactly our point, Ms. Chair, Senator Miller, excuse me. That's exactly the point that we're trying to make, is that if we're going to make improvements, and I don't care what the subject matter is, we're going to make improvements. I think that those are often best made at the local level, the level that's most responsive to the people that are having to live with the consequences of those. And whenever we preempt local activity and whatever subject matter we're talking about, we're taking away from essentially government the opportunity to experiment and to improve upon circumstances, the right, if you will, to be smarter tomorrow than we are today.
If, for example, I felt that the most local control was the decision made by an individual regarding what they wanted to do or not want to do. Let me just suppose I was a smoker and I wanted to go to a restaurant or bar and smoke a cigarette. Do you know of any statute that would prohibit that?
Do I know of any statute that would prohibit that?
City ordinance?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, yes, there are no smoking ordinances. They're in Corvallis for one, Eugene for another. The city of Salem is actively looking at that possibility now, and I understand the point that the senator is making. However, there's more to the issue than simply my right to smoke. It's not unlike the old saying that you have the right to swing your fist any way you like so long as it doesn't invade the province of my nose or something
like that. When you talk about people smoking in restaurants, we got to talk about the fact that it puts our employees in the community to a decision as to whether or not to take a job in a particular area that allows smoking and essentially be exposed to the secondhand smoke, or whether that set of jobs, which are for employers that allow smoking, is going to be cut out of the economic base of available jobs otherwise to fully employ your population. So we think there's some competing interests there that have to be weighed against the individual's right to smoke.
You're trying to mess up a statute that requires employees to stay with a particular employer under all circumstances?
No, it certainly doesn't, but to the extent that that employer allows smoking, it does say to those employees that do not smoke and do not wish to incur the exposure and liability, perhaps, or the exposure to the dangers of secondhand smoke, that thou may not work here. And we think that that's probably not a good policy to shrink the number of employment opportunities for your population base as a whole. Granted, it is a balancing. There are arguments to be made that the right of the individual business owner to decide this, the right of smokers to sequester an area that they can call their own and smoke at will and do whatever they wish to do to themselves, certainly there's an argument to be made to that. But you do then cut that employment opportunity out of the full scope of opportunities that we have for employment in that particular jurisdiction.
So this particular interference with a private employer is okay, but the one we might attempt here is not. So I just wanted to understand the thing. Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, I actually moved with the Senator Beyer to help me out. It's my recollection in 1993 and 1995, we passed the tax investment opportunities for local communities, that local communities would decide whether it was a tax abatement program.
Yeah, President.
In doing those, did not some communities contract with the new employer for a certain living wage benefit? So, for example, Fujitsu or Intel, didn't they contract with, like, Washington County or Multnomah County to pay their new hires a certain amount of wage?
Senator Brown, that's correct. There's actually two programs that I know of that allow that provision. One's the Strategic Investment Program that's been primarily used in the metropolitan area and allows governments to negotiate those things.
And
the other one is the Oregon Enterprise Zone law, which allows that type of negotiation for the fourth and fifth year tax abatement.
Okay. And Senator Beyer, House Bill 2744 overturn those agreements that counties have made with...
That's the attorney. That's me.
I'm looking at the most recent amendments that I've been handed, and it looks like there's an exemption for, and subparagraph C as a condition of providing direct tax abatements or subsidies for private employers with 50 or more employees. So I guess to the extent
under
that there's
circumstances, if we were to amend
50 or less,
that particular situation would be
exempt for those employers over 50. But again, the nexus there is you're using taxpayers' money in the process, and so it isn't just solely private employer dealing with some other private entity. They've got a public taxpayer subsidy to engage in the business that they're doing, and that I think gives some legitimacy to the government being concerned about those issues.
You know, Senator Brown, if it doesn't burn or shock you, then you're not going to get a good answer from Senator Brown. So.
I didn't even hear
anything. Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Perry, J.L. Wilson, Julie.
Julie, who? Did she have a name?
Julie hardly had a name.
Yes, I know. Right. We got one coming.
Yeah.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Perry from the Oregon Restaurant Association. We actually brought this bill forward. Right now in Oregon, we have, as you have heard, there's, to my knowledge, 5 living wage proposals, and none of them at this point deal with private employers. There's also documentation in my packet that says there's roughly 70 local governments doing this across the nation in 39 different states. Most of those, once again, are public employers, but as Senator Brown brought up and some other instances, some of these are trying to extend them to private employers. So what we are trying to accomplish with this bill is stop it from going to private employers before it starts. Because as these movements have happened across the country, they start with public and move to private. And so what we're trying to address is an employer has the right to pay their employees anything. In this case, the city, if they want to pay their employees more, they should have that right to. But if you take the city of Salem as an example and the proposed living wage ordinance that they have that I've seen discussed in the paper is $9.50, which is only to public employers at this time. But if you at some point extended that to privates and you look at Lancaster, for example, there's 4 to 5 restaurants on Lancaster that fall outside the city limits. If you oppose a $9.50 on one restaurant and not on the other, it could create some competitive issues just on the road of Lancaster alone. So that's what in the future we are trying to prevent from happening. In the House side, the issue of does public employers include contractual service agreements, which the examples of the bus workers in Corvallis and some janitorial service workers in Multnomah County was brought up, and that's why we added the last half of the last line on the A in Gross bill that says, or service contracts entered into local governments or whatever it is. At the last time when we were getting ready to head out to work session, Representative Rosenbaum brought up the issue of tax abatements in the enterprise zones, and so some union representatives gave me language that is the A5 amendments and asked if we would entertain the notion of adopting those, and I agreed to the union representatives that I would do that. And so we are supportive of the A5 agreements, or A5 amendments, because it is a process that's happening today that we're not trying to prevent. Once again, we are just foreseeing future advances to private businesses that has occurred in other states, and we want to try to prevent that from going. We do not feel that this bill argues for or against the arguments of minimum wage. It's just as you look at local governments and how their businesses are expanding outside of city and county boundaries, we don't want to have the competitive disadvantages that exist from higher minimum wages that we see in the living wages.
Bill, I missed your testimony, which I'm sure was very elucidating for the audience.
Rhetorical stylings is what I like to call it.
My comment is on California. And what was it, Santa Monica, Santa Clara, yeah, whatever, did this for one of the, and the argument at least the local officials were making is that the local area had spent a lot of money in terms of bringing tourists in, helping create the beach, and that these private employers along the beach certainly received some benefit from that. How would you respond to that?
Chair Harper, Senator Brown, one of the reasons why I think reached agreement with some of the union representatives on a direct condition of a direct tax abatement or subsidy is we feel that if businesses are going to be given some sort of a tax break, that is fine to do when you're discussing the tax break. And so I do not feel that as you're having those discussions, the question is that if there's a uniform tax cut of some portion, how it affects each individual type of industry is something I don't think any of us can explain today. So as long as they know when they're receiving the tax break what they have pro or con, I think the city should be able to enter into that discussion. And that's why if it's a uniform one across all business types, I just think that it's going to be very difficult. But should the city or the county have an ability to negotiate with that business in exchange for a tax break, I do not seem to have that much of a concern. Other panel members may, but I don't think that's much of a concern for us at this point. Does that answer your question?
I believe the answer to your question is it's called taxes.
Chair Hill.
Chair Harper, members of the committee, my name is J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB. Our viewpoint on the issue is just simply that minimum wage should be a statewide issue so that small business, many of whom are in a tenuous position anyway, are given a level playing field in what is really an ultra-competitive local marketplace. Our point of view, with the imposition of a local minimum wage in Salem, serves as a convenient example. You're dealing with, you're imposing competitive disadvantages on a group of business when they're, when they have competing businesses in very close proximity who are not saddled with the same kind of disadvantages. Unincorporated southeast Salem in the Four Corners area is a huge commercial area that would not fall under a locally imposed minimum wage. You have, of course, the city of Kaiser and a commercial center there that would not be saddled with a local minimum wage. You have businesses in close proximity with each other who are different, who are playing from a different playing field. Our point of view also is that you have one of the arguments for minimum wage is that the benefits accrue to a business as a worker has more disposable income to spend at a business. A local minimum wage kind of destroys that argument because there's no guarantee whatsoever that those forced to pay a higher wage will in turn have the benefits accrue to them, because to the extent that a higher minimum wage means higher prices, worse service, a minimum wage worker is just in tune to a good deal as anybody else, and they will go to Kaiser and they will go to Four Corners where they can get the best prices or the best service. So there's no guarantee that the benefits of a higher minimum wage accrue to those who are forced to pay it. That's our position. We support 2744, and I'm glad to answer questions.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Brown.
Would Jobs Plus be considered a subsidy?
What?
Jobs Plus program, would that be considered a subsidy under this bill? I think it would, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. I think this is a great bill, Mr. Chair.
Well, then I don't like it.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council.
So much for that work session.
We do support the A and Gross bill. As you may know, we represent a lot of national companies, and our companies try to keep their employee packages, benefit packages, as similar as possible. And they try to do that on a regional basis, and they try to do it on a locality basis. And I think if, as an example, we have a store in Albany and then a store in Corvallis, and one of the communities passes a living wage, it would be very difficult for us to offer a completely different benefit package 10 miles away. Additionally, national companies and the other companies we represent try to keep the best way to look at it is they only have so much money available for their total benefit packages, which is much more than the wage scale that's offered. Our employees consistently tell our member, the employees of our members consistently tell them that they want health care, they want retirement, they want broader vacation programs, and they want a cafeteria plan or a 125 plan, as well as a good wage, which I think competitively we do a very good job of. The problem is when we start to see, and I know the point's been discussed that we haven't seen this occur, but our concern is that it may occur. And this would allow us to keep relatively consistent, and then the most important thing is to provide the benefits that our employees consistently ask for. I did want to talk a little bit about the A5 amendments. I think Senator Brown has already caught something. And I didn't think of that. And maybe if I'd bumped into my friend Betsy out in the hallway, that might have come up. But as an example of the direct tax abatement and subsidy isn't well defined in the bill. That, for example, enterprise zones, as Representative Beyer probably, or Senator Beyer, pardon me, could explain, enterprise zones have wage scales within them. And I don't know if you're a company that's siting in an enterprise zone, if you're going to have a conflict with if the local government should have a wage they want to suggest, if you're going to have a conflict with the state law on a wage scale. And enterprise zones have a 10-year history of involvement on this. The other concern we have, and we don't mean, and maybe I should speak a little more personally about this as opposed to from the association, but sometimes local governments have reasons to target larger employers. Maybe they don't want the growth. Maybe they don't, want an industrial site. Whatever the case might be, and this might just be another sensitive issue that they could pick up on and say, sure, we're going to give you a subsidy, but you're also going to have to pay this. And my own personal experience is my husband's family was involved with the timber industry for three generations. And they were able to sell one of their companies to Georgia Pacific. The other company they had to close. And my husband has spent the last 2 years trying to make that a company again, that he can take the community members that his family employed for two generations back into a family-owned company. And he is working on getting a subsidy to get it restarted. Now, I think most of the people in the community would react very favorably to it. The bad or the good news is Corvallis has put a very beautiful bike path in right behind the industrial property. And part of that was because we said they could. And what I get concerned, or not we, I shouldn't say that's not really my family company, it's my husband's family company, but part of our concern would be there might be a vocal minority who says, we don't want that industrial site to start again. So what are the ways we can preclude it? And if there's some type of bullseye through some type of local wage that, or where the, let me rephrase this, if the community could say, we've given you the subsidy to redevelop that property, but now we're going to say you're going to have to pay this to your employees, that might again be a disincentive to my husband's family to restart that company in a different form. And it's not that we're opposed to the bill or AOI is going to drop dead over the amendments. It just might be better to, if we could have, clarify if Jobs Plus is a subsidy and what other targets there are in that language. It is a good bill. We feel it is necessary. Our employer, our members feel it's necessary as well.
Yeah, that little phrase, cast a wide net, or could. You mean unintended consequences in this business, Chair?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Beyer.
Question, maybe Craig can answer this. You're putting your hat on. In line 8, the term public and quasi-public corporations, public corporation, is that a traded company? And what is a quasi-public?
It's kind of like something that we don't know what it is either.
What about the interest you might say?
It's just you, it's a public safe. Those are the two. Aren't those the only two we have, right?
Well, C corporations, traded corporations, are often referred to as public corporations.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, to answer your question, I don't know.
What's a public contract? What does that mean?
For the record, Bill Perry of the Oregon Restaurant Association, basically, this was legislative council's version. It says a contract entered into with a public employer. Because I don't have a copy of the bill, so it doesn't. Public contracts entered into by local governments.
See, so that's
yeah, it could be anything as long as the local government is the one entering into it. And that's what to answer Senator Beyer's question, that this was basically intended to say public entities, and it does not include.
I know what you intended,
yeah.
But as
well, we had. I
tells us often. It's what you put the words in the statute.
I had extensive conversations with legislative council to make sure that private businesses were not included in this language, and we actually made some amendments to the language to take schools out because of different definitions and the community colleges. So they are excluded from this language that were taken out on the House side, but it is. Public bodies, in essence.
Are you sure?
Who
was definitely on this bill?
Doug McKean.
Where?
Doug McKean,
okay.
Because you got the term in here, public employers, in your A5s, which to me would mean that if the city of Salem chose to set this, they could set it for Shenandoah Community College, probably for the state of Oregon.
Well, we're not going too much further with this one today. Let's get some of these questions. We've got the subsidy question. We've got the true definitions. Yes, I'm important.
I'm just curious, the testimony. So your comments involve private to private, right, not public to private?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, yes, that is correct.
Your testimony, the City of Salem has developed or is developing a private to private? minimum wage?
No, Senator Courtney, Mr. Chairman, no. I have heard the same rumors that the mayor referenced that the city of Salem is considering. I haven't heard that anybody specifically, but in other states we have had extensions past their current proposal to go to private businesses.
So they gave, in effect, those three, they said they didn't know of any that had been private to private. That's not correct.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, I know Denver, the city of Denver tried to do a 715 one 2 years ago.
And what happened to that?
It actually got re-referred out to the ballot, and it narrowly was defeated.
And is there other ones? Or do you know?
To my knowledge, I believe the city of Houston. There are some, like Senator Brown referenced, that were the Wharf District of San Francisco, Santa Monica, and I think San Jose have all dealt with them, that have expanded past public bodies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And to reference the questions, too, on the subsidies and abatements, that's why the two words were added as a condition to a direct. And so it's only considered for negotiation purposes as they enter into businesses. So, to answer the question there.
Well, whether you love it or hate it, we need to know exactly what we're doing.
Did I ask this question?
Did you?
Could I ask a question?
Of course, yeah.
Would any tax-exempt organization come under your
motion? Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, no, because it's not a condition of, basically it would be anything that the city would enter into as a discussion. So mainly the biggest examples are the ones that came up, any property tax cuts, enterprise zones. But it's, like I said, it's the tax exempt status is not a condition that the city would negotiate.
So, so for a public employer, I'm trying to figure out where the YMCAs and the Boys and Girls Club and all those types of organizations may fit in here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, if they're negotiated tax cuts by the city would have an ability under this bill. And I would say that they have that ability today. This does not create new opportunities in this bill. What we're doing is, like I said, my percentage may be off, but I'm protecting 95% of the businesses, and I'm not protecting the other 5%. And that's, like I said, I don't know where that percentage falls. That's just a one for an example. But as of right now, this does not create more opportunities for local governments. It's, as was stated by the previous speakers, it restricts their potential to go farther than they are today.
All right. Close public hearing. That it? Did I forget a bill? You guys here for something else? Okay. We're adjourned.